Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
The Weekend Warrior, every Saturday morning from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m.
on ESPN LA 710.
Dedicated to you, the fan who works hard all week and slugs it out on the court, the field, the big box store, and the honey-do list all weekend long. And helping you cope as you come to the realization you're not 19 any longer. Here's board-certified orthopedic surgeon Dr. Robert Clapper.
Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. Listening, as you do every Saturday morning, and I appreciate it, to the Weekend Warrior Show. A lot of technical difficulties today, but we're going to get through it. My guest calling in at 8:15, I cannot wait to talk to him, the great Nate Johnson. And he's an expert in the stuff that we can still enjoy in life, which is going outside and listening to the birds singing to each other about spring is here. What exactly are those birds saying to each other? And we're going to learn. I read an article that he wrote in the LA Times sports section about the true meaning in what those birds are saying. And it's not what you think. It's not, hi, it's spring. Isn't it great when the birds are talking to each other? No. The birds are tweeting to each other, this is my backyard. Get the hell out of here. It's all about territorial language. He's an expert as a naturalist in what the trees are saying, what the birds are saying, what the ants are saying. It's a beautiful thing, and I can't wait to talk to him. But it made me think all week about the world of sports, the world of art, the world of surgery that I love. Where do we see that language of wildlife? Well, let's listen to the Tokens, The Lions Sleep Tonight, Rebecca. Let's listen to that song. You're listening to a song from 1961 that changed the world of rock and roll. The singer in that falsetto voice is Jay Siegel. Jay Siegel is a teenager growing up in Brooklyn. He used to go with his buddies, which is what they did in those days, to the street corner, and would sing doo-wop, a cappella songs. But Jay Siegel is singing a song that was written 100 years ago by a Zulu warrior in South Africa named Solomon Linda, who wrote a song because he was listening to the wilderness and heard a lion following his herd of cattle, and came up with this song, became a huge hit in South Africa. But the song in Zulu called The Lion is Mbube, M-B-U-B-E. Pete Seeger and the Weavers in the 50s misinterpreted that title and the Zulu language and called it Wimawe. And it was Jay Siegel who heard Pete Seeger's version of that song that was inspired by wilderness that led to The Lion Sleeps Tonight. So let's listen to the story behind this song. It's fascinating to me. Let's listen, 1 through 3, the story behind The Lion Sleeps Tonight.
It all began back in 1909 in what is present-day Swaziland, when a man by the name of Solomon Linda was born. Linda grew up in the Masinga, in rural Zululand, as a typical kid of the time. He herded cattle, and although he couldn't read or write, he had a connection to music and was strongly influenced by the new syncopated music that had swept across South Africa. In his 20s, he moved to Johannesburg, where he led an a cappella band that entertained local beer halls. It was in 1939 when a talent scout at Gallows Records invited Linda's group, the Original Evening Birds, to record an album. Here is where they would come to produce their most famous hit, Mbube, which is Zulu for lion. The song was inspired by an experience Linda had herding cattle, which a lion wouldn't leave his presence. The lyrics were so simple, but its call and response chants and harmonies were so mesmerizing that the song came to define a whole generation of Zulu a cappella singing. a style that became known simply as Mbube. Many music scholars say that the hit song was the first African record to sell 100,000 copies. And although record sales flourished, it wasn't until 1951 that it was released to the masses in the film Cry the Beloved Country.
Now let's listen to the sad truth behind The Lion Sleeps Tonight, 1 through 3.
The story begins in Johannesburg, South Africa, 1938. A group of Zulu singers called Solomon Lunda and the Evening Bird step into the first recording studio ever set up in sub-Saharan Africa, and they record a song called Mube, which in Zulu stands for the lion, and it sounded like this.
We move up. We move up.
However, a copy of the record managed to make its way to New York City in the early 1950s, where it was found in a pile by legendary folklorist Alan Lomax. Without actually hearing any of the records in the box from Africa, Lomax thought his friend Pete Seeger, a famous folk singer at the time, would be interested in them.
Now let's listen to Women Way the Jay Siegel story, 1 through 5.
Okay, when I was about 15 years old, I lived in Brooklyn, New York, in a little town called Brighton Beach. And in the summertime, that's what we used to do. We used to hang out on the beach. And every few blocks was a different singing group. And every time we used to sing this song, it used to draw a big crowd. Everybody used to hear this, and they used to run over to listen to us sing the song. And also, that's how we used to get the girls, because the girls used to come over, and that's how we used to meet girls, by singing on the beach. And little did I know, that little song that we used to sing for fun on the beach would become a number one record all over the world, and it was the biggest hit in the history of rock and roll. And it went a little bit like this. It went, we are number one. And that became The Lion Sleeps Tonight. I was in the chorus in my high school, and this kid was sitting next to me. His name was Neil Sedaka, and he started this rock and roll group. And we made a few records, and we did a couple of TV shows back when I was only about 16 years old. And after a while, we broke up, and Sedaka went on his own, and we reformed the Tokens again. And that started our career off. Tonight I Fell in Love, our first big hit record. Very complicated lyric. Anybody can relate to those kind of lyrics. You know, I fell in love, I want the stars above to know it, tonight I fell in love, you know. But those were the songs back then. That was a, you know, that was a big hit, but, you know, that was a one hit. Who knew what was going to happen after that record? We didn't want to be a one hit wonder, as they call them, you know. And our contract was almost going to be over, and we went up to our producers, and they asked us, what else do we have? And I started to sing Whim Away, and they said, well, that's very unusual. We recorded the song. It was a very strange record for the time, which I still think it is for this time. It's still very unique. And the other guys in the group didn't want that record to come out. They thought it was too weird. It's never going to happen. I said, I think it has a shot, and I think it could be a commercial success. We were at a meeting at RCA Victor, and the president of RCA Victor called us up to his office. He said, I'm sending you guys to Rome to do a show in Rome. So we all thought we're going to Rome, New York. You know, Rome, Italy? We did a big, big TV show, and the biggest variety show all over Europe. It was called Studio One.
Okay, let's now recognize that this all was inspired by learning from the wilderness in art. Jay Siegel, Weem Away, became The Lion Sings Tonight. What about in the world of sports, where the inspiration comes from the wildlife? There was nobody better than the jockey, Willie Shoemaker. There's two examples where his intimacy with learning how horses communicate at the Kentucky Derby, both winning at age 54 because he could communicate with this horse, Ferdinand, and beat the odds and won the race, the oldest jockey to ever win the Kentucky Derby. But also in losing, in May of 1957, he miscalculated, not the horse, but he miscalculated the finish line, stood up because he thought it was over, and the horse did what he said, even though he knew the other horses were right next to him, outrunning him. So let's go to Kentucky Derby victories, 1 through 4.
May 4th, 1957. And that 83rd Kentucky Derby will long be remembered by jockey Bill Shoemaker and others for the quality of those who ran.
That might have been the best field of any derby ever run, because there's about five horses in there were really, really top horses. And they all proved it the next year because they all won big stake races as four-year-olds all over the country.
The race came down to this dramatic stretch drive, with Shoemaker on the outside on Gallant Man and Bill Hartack on the inside riding Iron Liege. Deep in the stretch, Gallant Man on the lead, Shoe, thinking he had reached the finish line, raised up.
The mistake I made, it happened so fast, I wasn't able to get him out before the Kentucky Derby that day. I only had the one mount, and that was Gallant Man. And that track is a lot different than most tracks. The finish line is like a 16th of a mile further towards the first turn than any track in the country. And that's how I made the mistake, misjudged the finish line.
Shoemaker had lost the 1957 Kentucky Derby by a nose. Even worse for Shoe, he believed it was his error that cost Gallant Man the victory and handed jockey Bill Hartack the first of his five Derby wins.
I think it was the difference. I think I would have won that race, yeah, if I could have kept riding him hard, yeah.
What helped get Shoemaker through the biggest mistake of his entire racing career was the support of Gallant Man's owner, Ralph Lowe.
Well, he was disappointed, and so was I, because I made that mistake. But the stewards told me they thought it was an honest mistake. They weren't going to take any action. And I went to Dallas, Texas to see Mr. Lowe, and about a week later I got a telegram from them, the steward, saying that because of the importance of the race and all the coverage, television coverage that they got, they were compelled to suspend me 15 days for making that mistake. And Ralph Lowe got mad at the stewards. And he said, well, I'm not going to run my horse in the Preakness. I'll wait till the Shoemaker gets up and run him in the Belmont. And that's what he did.
Didn't he have a gift for you and all that?
Oh, he sent me a new automobile, a big, beautiful Chrysler, to kind of make me feel a little better because I really felt bad.
And that at age 54 in 1986, the oldest jockey ever to win the Kentucky Derby, because he could communicate with that animal, with Ferdinand. Listen to the Bill Shoemaker story, number 5.
There was always a distinctive look to the way Shoe rode a race. It's been said that Bill Shoemaker bothered a horse less than any other jockey. The craft of a jockey is not just skill and intelligence and physical conditioning. It's timing and touch and intuitive reaction. When that timing is missing, so are the wins.
The timing, the touch, how to communicate with a horse. What are the birds really saying in your backyard? That lion following that herd of cattle in Swaziland, and the Zulu herder who became a singer, Solomon Linda, which became The Lion Sleeps Tonight. There's a whole world out there that I would just love to learn more about. And coming up next, I'm going to be talking to a man who knows all about that world, the wilderness that surrounds us, even in an urban center of Los Angeles, the great Nate Johnson. Coming up next on the Weekend Warrior Show here on 710 ESPN.
Check this out.
Weekend Warrior is on the air.
From the epicenter of sports in the Southland.
ESPN LA 710. With Dr. Robert Clapper, board-certified orthopedic surgeon at Cedars-Sinai Health Associates.
Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. We're listening to Bill Withers, who just recently passed away. Hit after hit after hit. A man who did it his own way. The great Bill Withers. Joining me now, I'm so excited to talk to him, the great Dr. Nathaniel Johnson. Nate, thanks so much for getting up early to be with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So, I took inspiration from your article, and I'm so glad to be able to talk to you about where in other areas can you be in tune with the wildlife that's around us. And I hope you appreciate The Lion Sleeps Tonight and Willie Shoemaker.
I love it.
So, I want to know, and all the listeners want to know, who are you? Where did you grow up? What did your father do for a living? What school did you go to? And how did this journey begin leading to you being a naturalist?
All right, the whole life story. Well, I was born here in Berkeley, California. My parents were hippies that met in Berkeley in the 60s, if you do. And when I got to be about 3 years old, my dad noticed I was falling down on the sidewalk and skinning my knees. And he thought, you know, we got to get back to the garden. We got to get back to nature because this is technology injuring my little boy here. So, so we moved up to Nevada City, up about halfway between Sacramento and Tahoe in the California foothills. And that was a lovely place to grow up, this old gold mining town in the forest and running around the woods and you know, playing with the banana slugs and the newts and the climbing trees and that sort of thing. And so I really developed a love of nature there. And, you know, just reading these books about, you know, like Sign of the Beaver, you know, you read these books about kids living in harmony with nature, and you say, gosh, as a kid, that's wonderfully romantic, right? So I learned all about the trees in my neighborhood and the different animals that I'd come into contact with. But then, you know, as you get older, you get busy, you have to earn a living, you sort of forget about these things. And it wasn't until I sort of lost touch with the wildlife around me until I had a kid of my own. And so my daughter was, when she was about 1 year old, she was doing this thing, and I think parents around the world will probably recognize this, where you're trying to get somewhere and your kid has found something disgusting in the gutter, and they're poking. Give me a break. Come on. We gotta get home. But then I'd go and look, and she'd have found something interesting. She'd found some crazy spider or a snail that was, you know, chewing down this, you know, big leaf. And you could see that the teeth marks. If you look closely, you don't realize snails have teeth. And I thought, oh, wait a second. You know, I used to be really into this. And am I going to bring up my daughter just to be, you know, I'm telling her, forget about this. We got to get to the next thing. You know, this isn't worth paying attention to. I didn't want to do that. I really wanted to be able to teach her that same wonder and awe that I had had, even though we were living in the city, we were living in San Francisco at the time. And so I started trying to do my research and figure out what are all the non-human neighbors that are around us that I've sort of blinded myself to as I've had a little less time to concentrate on them.
You know, it's what a great story. I took my grandson recently to UCLA to their botanical garden.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to point out the different trees and bushes. But God bless UCLA, because next to the plaque that tells you the name of the bush or the tree, for example, ginkgo biloba tells you all the medicinal effects of that tree that you're looking at, which is beautiful. So the connection and being aware of what nature can teach us goes beyond just listening to the bird tweet, and it goes deeper than that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's, and ginkgo is very important, especially in Chinese medicine, and it's been investigated. You know, there's some connections, there's some indications that there may be some usefulness in, you know, the Western medicine as well.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a fascinating one for several reasons. I don't know if you walk around, that's a street tree. And if you walk around during the fall, ginkgos are one of these trees that has males and females.
And really?
Yeah. So the females, and they tend not to plant the females because the females produce this fruit that around September or October, if you're walking under one, you'll know it because all of a sudden it'll smell terrible. It smells awful. And it sort of has this crinkled, yellowish, decaying looking quality that, that must have been to attract some kind of animal that's long extinct now that, you know, would eat this and carry the seed off to some other place.
Mm.
In China, they take, you know, they go and they gather these up, they clean off the sort of disgusting outer fruit, and they roast the seeds inside, and they produce these sort of, they're almost like gnocchi. It's this kind of soft, very mellow tasting seed that then is used in all kinds of Chinese cooking. And of course, Chinese cooking is just bound up 100% with Chinese medicine. So you have the right meal to address the issue with whatever you're experiencing.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, and that I don't know. I can tell you the other reason I really love ginkgo trees, if you like.
I do.
Yeah. So, the fascinating thing to me about ginkgo trees, I mentioned that they produce these fruits for probably some kind of animal that was like a squirrel but is now extinct. And extinct is the key word there because these are really living fossils. These are a tree that comes out of deep, deep time. So ginkgo trees used to be this part of this huge ginkgo phyte family. It's somewhere they evolved right after ferns. They're really more like ferns than other flowering plants. And they used to be all over the world. You see, because they have those tough leaves, you can really see them in fossils all over the world. But then as the climate changed and it cooled and it warmed and the dinosaurs died off, so did the ginkgo trees. And they died out of North America and they died out of Europe. And they at last were left in just one little valley in China. And that was going to be the end of them. You know, all their relatives died completely. They were left all alone. If we were as alone as the ginkgo trees, all of our, you know, all of the mammals would have been dead. All the monkeys, all the birds, the closest living relative that we'd have left would be something like a starfish. You know, just everything.
Wow.
There are these survivors out of deep time. And then the climate changed a little bit. They were able to hang on. And people came along and they found these trees and they thought, this is a cool tree. And it just so happens that they grow really well in cities. They grow in these tough situations where there's not a ton of light and there's pollution and they're between the sidewalks and people are spitting on them and throwing gum down, but they thrive. And so out of all these environments that they were dying off, and here comes this strange environment of the city where they're able to flourish, and people found them and they brought them back to the Netherlands, and then they brought them to botanical gardens in the U.S. and they spread across the world. And now they're in almost every city. So every time I see one of those, I think, gosh, here's this thing that's connected to the dinosaurs. And I made
hands
on it.
You're amazing, Nate. Listen, can you hang on a second? Because I want to talk about what drew me to you to begin with, which is opening my back door and walking into my backyard and what the birds are saying now that spring is here. Can you hang on a second?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Well, we're talking to the great Nate Johnson, a naturalist, about the world that's right next to us, that we need him to open our eyes and our ears. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warriors Show here on 710 ESPN.
Check this out.
Weekend Warrior is on the air.
From the epicenter of sports in the Southland.
ESPN LA 710. With Dr. Robert Clapper, board-certified orthopedic surgeon at Cedars-Sinai Health Associates.
Ain't no sunshine when she...
Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. The great Bill Withers. May he rest in peace. I'm joined by the great Nate Johnson from Berkeley, California. Nate, what a pleasure to talk to you. Your passion. You know what they say, you want to have a happy life, find the gift God gave you and share it with the world. You've got the gift and you're sharing it with us. And I really, we all appreciate you making time to be with us. I want to ask you a question. I walk out my backyard and I hear the birds because it's April. It's spring. Yeah. Whether it's a sparrow, a warbler, a robin, a blue jay, a dove, what are the birds saying to each other? Can you tell by the song, by the sound they're making, the species? Do you still have to look? Take us through the right way we should walk into our backyard and observe and listen.
Yeah, you can tell a lot about what's going on. They're all talking to each other, and they're talking to other species as well. So there's this real, it's like the cable news going on, you know, it's like the chatter of all the frequencies of radio and TV that the humans are spitting back and forth. So the birds are doing the same thing. They're warning each other about predators. They're fighting. They're looking for mates. And if you know how to tune into that, you can hear the news too. So it's pretty cool. So I think the right way to go about doing this is, first of all, accept that this is one of the harder things about being a naturalist. It's kind of easy to go out and look at trees and appreciate them, but you go and you listen to birds. It's just this mishmash of, especially in the springtime. There's, you know, you go out in the morning, there's just a million different things going on. And I still have a lot of trouble distinguishing the different species by their calls. So it's difficult. But if you just spend a little time listening, it's often amazing what is there right in front of you if you can just slow down enough to hear. And you don't have to know exactly what species this is or exactly what it's saying. You can kind of tell by the urgency of the call. If something is very loud and fierce, it's obvious that a fight is going on. You know, I compare it to, if you've ever heard opera, you don't have to know Italian to tell if this is a love song or if people are angry at each other. If you have your eyes open, you'll see birds squabbling and fighting. And then you'll start to hear these little short, everything will go quiet, and you'll hear these little beep, beep, these little alarm calls where they're telling each other, look out, there's a cat coming, or look out, I just saw a red-tailed hawk fly over, and you'll probably also hear this when you first go out. You'll still hear bird song from farther away, but you'll notice that if you sit there quietly for a moment, all of a sudden birds all around you that were quiet start singing again.
Wow!
The main thing that's going on right now is, as you said, it's spring. And a lot of the birds have come back from warmer areas, and they're establishing themselves in their nests, or the males will set up in a tree and say, this tree is my tree. And so it sounds like they're just singing for joy, you know, that it's spring, it's beautiful. But really what's going on is they're saying, this is my tree, and you better stay away. And if you are a female of my species, you can come listen to my song. I'm going to defend this tree. We'll build a nest. This tree is mine, mine, mine. So it's really this this sort of bravado, chest thumping, claiming of territory that's happening right now.
Nate, take us through, if possible, in this beautiful life and respect you have for the planet that you're living on, more so than the rest of us, do you have a moment that you can share with us where the bird or the animal looked back at you and you really felt connected one-on-one? As a surfer, there is a seal that loves to play in the harbor that I surf in, or the cove. And I swear, when I paddle out, there may be four other guys in the ocean, but that guy comes looking for me. Maybe I smell a certain way. I look a certain way. I don't know. He has a passion for Jews in the ocean. I don't know what. But he looks at me, and I look back, and he's not scared. I'm not scared. It's an amazing moment that I have, and I look forward to seeing him every Sunday when I go surfing. Do you have a moment where you're in the forest and you one-on-one you saw a woodpecker or something that all of a sudden you connected with?
Yeah, I've seen seals out. I'm a kayaker. The surfers call us butt surfers because we don't have to be able to get up on our feet. I've seen them. I've seen them pop up. You know, they're like puppies almost. But the but for the experience that you're talking about, I think even more profound. You know, as a kayaker, we want to be out on these wild rivers coming down from the mountains, not out in the ocean. And so I was up on the Klamath River in Northern California, and you know, we're dancing down the rapids, and I pull off into this eddy, and in the eddy, this head pops up, and it's a river otter, and it wow. looks at me in a very similar way, I think. And then it jumps off and swims into the current and catches a wave and actually, you know, they can surf. It's surfing on this wave, and then it dives underneath and it pops back up into the eddy and looks at me again. I knew the game was afoot, right? It was my job. So I paddled all I was worth and caught the same wave. And, you know, I couldn't surf quite as well as the otter could, but it was this wonderful moment of interspecies play.
Wow. That's fantastic. I grew up on Jamaica Bay, where the jets and planes would land at JFK, and they literally came over our house, and I had a little rowboat, and I used to just go out into the water and fish. And it was a really great place to grow up in terms of natural beauty. Yeah. And only recently did I learn that the birds that surrounded me in Jamaica Bay, that they tagged some of them, and they would fly to Brazil and then come back. I mean, amazing. I cannot imagine the distances these birds that I'm hanging around with are traveling. Is the same true for the birds that are in my backyard here in Los Angeles?
Some of them, yeah. I mean, the common songbirds that we see, some of them fly up to Alaska and
wow.
down into Mexico. Some of the shorebirds around here fly from pole to pole.
God,
and we don't really know. We see, oh, this is, you know, this must be this thing. It's around all the time. It's not really worth looking at. There must not be anything too special about these things. But these are the birds, the creatures that they make nature documentaries about.
Wow, you're incredible, Nate. Where did you go to college?
I went to Pomona College just east of L.A.
Oh, and you have a PhD in biology?
No, I have I'm just a communicator. I have a master's in journalism, and I sort of think of myself as a utility player naturalist. So I just pick up every book that I can and spend a lot of time whenever I meet someone who is a specialist in trees or ants or whatever. I just glom onto them and try and make them my friend.
And the books you've written, so we can learn more about what you're passionate about.
So the book that is closest to this conversation is called Unseen City, which tells the story of my daughter, and I try and take 10 different animals, 10 different creatures, I should say, because there's plants as well, that are so common in cities that we've stopped seeing them. You know, things like pigeons and the weeds growing up through the cracks, that no matter where you are, you're going to have these things. And I try to make them as awe-inspiring as walking through, you know, mere woods between the redwoods. And then,
Nate, amazing. So do you have a website? How could we follow what you're up to?
Yeah, my website is NathanielJohnson.org. Okay. And I have unusual spelling, but I think the easiest way is if you search for Nathaniel Johnson, if you just Google me, you know, I write regularly for the environmental magazine Grist. I'm on staff there, and I'm on Twitter as Savertooth. So NathanaEL is the Old Testament spelling of Nathaniel.
Nate, in a world that seems to be crumbling all around us, to be able to rejoice by just opening the window and kind of getting more insight into what the sounds are that we're hearing, you definitely have brightened up many people's mornings going forward. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Really a pleasure.
Well, you've brightened up mine. Thank you so much.
Okay, Nate. We'll be in touch. The great Nate Johnson. All right, Warriors, coming up next, the clinic will be open. I'm going to take your calls. The number is 877-710-ESPN. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warriors show here on 710 ESPN.
Check this out. Weekend Warrior is on the air.
From the epicenter of sports in the Southland.
ESPN LA 710. With Dr. Robert Clapper, board-certified orthopedic surgeon at Cedars-Sinai Health Associates.
Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. That's the great Bill Withers. May he rest in peace. Let's take some calls. The clinic will be open. I had so much fun talking to Nate Johnson, though. Wow. Now let's talk to you guys, the Weekend Warriors. Let's go to Edwin. Edwin, you're on with Dr. Clapper. How can I help?
Hello.
Hi, Edwin. It's Dr. Clapper. How can I help?
Well, hi, Dr. Clapper. I am a huge fan of yours. I've been listening to your show for many years. You're actually the smartest man I know in medicine on the radio. So,
thank you.
Trust me, a lot of people pretty much know that about you. So you're well-respected and all that. So I believe if people would go to people like you for questions about this thing, the COVID-19, it will be a lot more people educated, because medicine is such an incredible field to be studying in, right? And not a lot of people really know how to answer these questions. Instead of going to YouTube, all you have to do is just go to a person that knows about medicine, like yourself. You know, it's not your expertise. We all know that, but you know, if anything comes out from you, it will be like you know, the next best thing in terms of information, right? So, yes.
I will give you then, what ultimately is going to help is when, and they're working on it and it'll happen, is a vaccine. And that's what ultimately is going to allow us to return to the stadium, to return to work, to be amongst other people, because people like being around other people. And this is just a giant reset button and timeout. And maybe, you know, not to justify, you can't justify a pandemic, but boy, are you rethinking your life and the rat race that we've been in, like those gerbils that just keep running on that circle. This is forcing us all to rethink it all. But this too shall pass. Thanks to great minds and great scientists, they will have a vaccine. I don't know when. Nobody knows when it's going to happen, but we will be able to return to a normalcy. And I can't thank you enough for the kind words, Edwin. Thank you so much for being a Weekend Warrior and being a fan. And God bless you. All right, let's take Lee. Let's take another call. Are you there, Lee?
Yes, I am. How are you doing today?
How are you doing? What do you do for a living?
I'm a sound engineer. So
sound
I
engineer. So you can appreciate the difficulty that I'm having today. Sound.
definitely, man. Hey, but you guys getting through. I listen to the station all day, every day, so you guys are getting through it. It sounds
yes.
About 90% where we need to be.
Okay, thank you. And where did you grow up? What did your father do for a living?
I grew up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, before I moved to California. And my dad is still a city bus driver.
No way. Would he come home at night and sit at the dinner table and tell you about all the interesting people he met that day? Or would he come home and not want to talk about his job?
He would come home and not want to jump right into sports and watch his game.
who was his team? Who was his fan?
He was a big Magic Johnson fan way back in.
Oh.
So he was a big Magic Johnson. You know, that was really, back in the day, it was really like, you know, back in Indiana, you get to see the Pistons play, you get to see the Celtics play the Lakers, and then you get to see maybe Houston Rockets or the Bulls every now and then. But it was mostly Lakers, yeah.
And how about you? Are you a Laker fan?
I guess you would say a closet Laker fan.
Okay. Don't tell me you're a Clipper fan. I'm going to hang up on you right now.
Hold on. I'm a closet Clipper fan too, but I'm a Maverick fan. I was watching the rookie game, I think it was like 97-98, and I seen Dirk Nowitzki play. And I seen this awkward looking 7-foot dude trying to shoot threes and everything. And I followed him, and that was my favorite player, so that was Maverick fan.
He's amazing. Dirk Nowitzki, what a pleasure and a blessing to be able to watch that guy. And he had the secret to his success, they say, was his trainer who taught him how to shoot off. Kind of like what Steph Curry does, where he shuts the lights off in the stadium and makes like a strobe light. He makes it as distracting as possible, and he trains with half-court shots so that a three-point shot is easier. Mm-hmm. Well, Dirk Nowitzki was the first one to do that, to actually strain in shooting so that the regular shot was easier. I love that guy. I agree with you. How can I help you? I've got a few minutes left.
Okay. So real quick, it's not on my behalf. It's on my sister's behalf real quick. So she had seizures, Petamol, so not the full ones, but the Petamol ones. So she had surgery in 2004, brain surgery to correct it. And towards the end of December, she started having severe migraines.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, due to the Covina situation, she can't really get an EKG right now or anything. Mm-hmm. All the specialists are taken away, at least back there in Indiana. So I don't know if it was the same situation out here in California. And it is. Okay.
Well, this is what I would tell you. At Cedars, we're blessed. There is probably the brightest neurosurgeon that you can have, and his name is Keith Black.
Okay.
And what I would tell you is do some homework to help your sister out. Try to call his office on Monday and see if you can figure out how to get, maybe he's doing virtual, like I'm doing appointments with patients. You know, you may be able to get to him and his office, and that might be something that would be a worthy second opinion for your sister. If anybody can figure out what to do next with her, he's the guy. If anybody knows anything about how the brain works, it's Keith Black. So that's what I would encourage you to do. You'd be surprised. You know, I'm from New York. They say that the Missouri's the show me state. You know what New York is? It's the why not state. Why not call him? See if you can get a hold of someone, and they can certainly steer you in the right direction. There's a neurologist here in Los Angeles that I think the world of, and his name is Steven Sykes, S-Y-K-E-S. He's another person that I would, on Monday, give his office a call. Between Keith Black and Steve Sykes, you'll be doing your sister a favor by at least getting another opinion where someone's thinking maybe outside the box. No offense to Indiana, but why not get an opinion from someone here in Los Angeles who I'm giving the blessings of knowing what they're doing?
And that's why I think that the best call I made was to you. That's why I told us.
Well, that's very gracious of you. I appreciate that. And thanks for listening. You listen every Saturday. You know what Clapper Vision is?
I definitely do, man. You gave me Clapper Vision a couple of years ago when I tore my Achilles after Kobe did, how to repair mine and what to do. Yep.
Well, it's a pleasure to take care of you, even if it's over the radio. And thanks so much for listening. God bless you. Have a good day. All right, Warriors. I leave you with Volare, which means I'm singing and I'm flying. And that's what we got to keep on doing. Until next week, I'll see you on the radio.